Hello, and welcome to our program. Today, we're going to be talking about evolving paradigms for the management of chronic kidney disease and cardiovascular comorbidities. I'm Dr. Eden Miller. I am a family practitioner by training, a diabetologist, and I have my fellowship in obesity medicine. I work at my clinic, Diabetes and Obesity Care, in Bend, Oregon. Joining me today is Kim Zuber. Hey, Kim, can you introduce yourself, please?
Surely. My name is Kim Zuber. I'm a PA in nephrology and have been for the last 35 years. I practiced in the DC metro area for the full 35 years and recently moved down here to St. Petersburg, where it's gorgeous. And I am finally doing all those things I told my patients to do. I'm biking, I go to senior exercise classes, and I'm spending a lot of time teaching about CKD.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to have a great time. It's also one of my passions to educate my colleagues, to equip them with those tools to intervene with our patients.
Exactly. Thank you.
So let's start off the discussion with a little bit of background regarding chronic kidney disease and why it's so important. You know, we can see on this slide that it's this continuum. You know, you might jump into the circle with elevated blood pressure, and many of us know that it's that silent killer that ultimately, if left untreated, kind of drifts into chronic kidney disease, which then morphs into stress and inflammation and endothelial dysfunction. And over time, this acute change turns into chronic change, and then we get this cardiovascular renal remodeling. And then cardiovascular disease, which then puts additional stress onto the individual, creating this cycle. You know, I often like to talk to my patients about how I believe the kidney is queen. She sits on her throne and she directs the other organs. And often if she's happy, everybody else is happy. But when she's not happy, things tend to decompensate from there. So Kim, how do you approach your patients with having this discussion about the start and the cycle of chronic kidney disease?
All my patients have cardiovascular disease. Let's face facts. This group as a whole, just having chronic kidney disease means you also have less function in the kidney and things back up. And so if hypertension didn't cause your kidney failure or your kidney disease, your kidney disease will cause hypertension. My patient population dies off at stage four. Very few patients actually make it on to kidney failure. 70 to 80% of patients with chronic kidney disease will die of cardiac factors. Cardiac factors are the most important ones. And so it's important that we look at this from a holistic point of view and not just treat just the blood pressure, just the diabetes, just the kidney disease, because it is a whole interaction between them all.
Yeah, and we have these players, these hormonal players that come in, and these are opportunities for intervention. We know about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. We're learning more about the mineral corticoid pathway and that whole hyperglycemic, how it develops kind of this almost this soup of inflammation and oxidative stress. You know, can you comment for us a bit about, you know, just briefly letting our listeners know about those systems and how we tend to identify them and intervene with them on more of a global kind of level?
That's just it, is that we talk to the patients on a global level because we'll explain to them, yes, your kidneys are having some issues. By the time you meet me, you're at stage four or 3B at the most, but you have already lost a huge amount of kidney function. And so therefore, all of those other systems have already been activated. The RAST is going crazy and the cardiovascular is just, and so the remodeling has occurred. My patients are all with left ventricular hypertrophy just from the fact that they've had less function in their kidney over the years.
You know, it's kind of like you're the end of the line. And one thing that comes up as we're talking is me as a primary care, I'm the beginning of the journey. And so My job is to try and make it so they don't see you. I'm very glad, yes. Very glad you're there to help them with that. But so much intervention and identification can be done early, right? Before this cascade has occurred, before they're at, you know, 3B renal failure and they're manifesting cardiovascular disease. And I think it can be challenging for many of primary care physicians to start having conversations around chronic kidney disease because it has these subtle findings. And I'll be honest with you, it just doesn't hurt yet. And so we're often not compelled to intervene or identify until it's already hurt. And in kidney disease, I'm sure you would agree with me, identification and prevention are probably where it's at.
And that's just it. And that's one of the reasons why we're having this conversation, because if you don't identify patients, and 90% of patients nationwide are not identified yet, if you were to pull their labs, they are CKD patients, but we're not catching them early. And so then they meet me. And once you meet me, you never get rid of me. You'll meet me, you'll know me through dialysis, you'll know me through transplant. One of us, unfortunately, will go first. I'm hoping it's not me, but it is something that is lifelong. And this is part of the problem. We need to get to them early when we can still stop where the progression's going.
Well, that's a great introduction for, I think what we're going to talk about next is testing and monitoring for chronic kidney disease and its complications. Thank you so much for diving deep into that pathophysiologic causes.
Oh, you know us, nephrology loves that kind of stuff.
Let's take a moment and look at testing and monitoring for chronic kidney disease. What if we had a patient? I see this all too often in my primary care setting. It's a typical person, they've had diabetes for, let's say, 8 years. And, you know, we get that chemistry panel, the estimated EGFR there, it's there, I see it. I'm kind of making sure it's at the right level, that it's not in bold or red, but there's no indications that a urinary albumin creatinine ratio was done, oftentimes not even for the last 18 months. Hey, Kim, can you kind of illuminate what we call this kind of subclinical chronic kidney disease where the EGFR isn't telling us enough? Can you go into that a little bit for us?
Sure. We published this in KDIGO, which is Kidney Disease Improving Global Outcomes. We published this at the turn of the century, and yet it does not seem to be out in primary care as much as we would like. We have 5 stages, 1 through 5, but 3 was split into 3A and 3B, mostly because certain medications are fine at a GFR of 59, but not at 32 or 39, whichever, you know, numbers were at, most of them being diabetes medications, which is, again, a big overlap between your patient population and mine. And so this took the stages, but we also know we need to know who to worry about. Everybody loses kidney function as you get older. So we're not worried about the 85-year-old who has no albumin. Albumin is pathognomonic and predictive. It will tell you who will end up with me. And what we know is a lot of times the albumin is not being tested. Albumin is one type of protein. Protein includes, you know, light chains, heavy chains. It includes the Benz-Jones, alpha chains, gamma chains, but albumin is pathognomonic and specific for CKD. You could be a patient with a GFR of 100, but if you're dumping a bunch of albumin, you'll meet me within the year. And again, nobody really likes to meet me. But you could be a patient with a GFR of 30. And if you're not dumping any albumin, you and I shall never meet. What we also know is if you walk into a dialysis unit in that population, you will see more patients of color. And part of that question was, are we the problem? Are we the one who's causing more patients of color to end up on dialysis? Because again, that's where we're trying to predict who will go and we're trying to stop them from going. And so because of this, the ASN and the NKF put together a task force, which reported at the end of 2021 about a new EGFR calculator.
So what you're telling me, Kim, is that you need more than a serum blood check for kidney. You need to complement that with at least an annual urinary albumin-creatinine ratio. So you've got the serum markers, you got the urine markers, and that's going to determine where you fall on those stages of chronic kidney disease. It's also going to determine, like you said, in a predictive manner, who's going to progress. And so that's so essential to have those two pieces.
Exactly. And I have to say, the diabetic community, the endocrine community, has been wonderful. Part of that may be that little EHR pop-up that says, did you order a urine? However, that is a small population of our patients who will go on to kidney failure. And it should also have pop-ups for anybody with hypertension, kidney stones, chronic UTIs, anybody above the age of 60, which is how they define as older, which I find very offensive. But again, 60 is considered high risk for CKD.
You know, can I ask you another question? Oftentimes in my primary care travels, I'll get the question regarding EGFR and how it's calculated, what it represents. Let's go through a little bit of the recommendations regarding that new GFR calculator.
Exactly. The original calculator, the Cockroach-Gault, was published in 1976, and it actually was used. We did a measured and an estimated GFR. It was 249 white males hospitalized. As you can imagine, creatinine is produced by muscle mass. So this was a very bizarre group that was used to develop our calculators. And from 76 to 99, that was the calculator we used. We thought women were, about 15% smaller than a male. I mean, literally, it was arbitrarily selected. In 1999, again, it was the MDRD, which is the modification of diet and renal disease. We thought if we had patients on a low protein diet, they would be less likely to progress. So I had a lot of patients in that trial because one of the sites was Hopkins. And 30 years later, we find that, no, we got a good calculator out of it, but we could not slow progression by switching around diet. Now we know it may be plant-based protein versus animal-based protein, but what we do know is these calculators are plus or minus 30%. And so when we went and we looked and we saw so many patients of color were already to the dialysis level, and that was one of the variables in our calculator, we went back and we looked and we saw that it did make a huge difference. So this new EGFR calculator puts in gender, serum creatinine, which again is not exact. We would prefer cystatin C, but there's you don't have standardization all nationwide in the labs, and the cost is significant. It's the send out. It's not done locally. And so as of January 1st, 22, everybody was moving to the new EGFR calculator, which is called the CKD Epi 2021. It adjusts slightly weight, hard to believe, but Americans are getting heavier. I know you don't see that in your breath. But we also adjust it slightly with gender and height. And this new calculator, the National Kidney Foundation has a nice little mobile app that you can download. I have been told by the powers to be that Quest, LabCorp, the VA, Mayo, the big centers, Yale, Stanford, Cleveland Clinic, have all gone to the new calculator. However, I was talking to one of the lab techs at Quest, and she said, oh no, we're doing the new calculator and everything else. And yet when I got a patient report back, it had, if African-American, if not. So I'm not sure on uptake, but this is where you should calculate your patients. You should use this calculator, and you may have to do it separately than the reports coming back to you.
Well, that is so helpful, because I wasn't aware that those initial standardization and ranges were so exclusive and not inclusive. And so it's very encouraging to me that what we're doing is making a transition. And it might be a while for transitioning, but those participants could really take their own practice in a new direction and do this calculation. I'm so glad we have that little QRS code to do that. But it really does give us an individualized approach to calculating eGFR, which is really what we want to do. Exactly. Now that we've demonstrated, it's so imperative to accurately measure an eGFR, to obtain a urinary albumin creatinine ratio. Let's talk a little bit about how good, or rather how poorly, we are doing this in the United States for screening those at risk for chronic kidney disease.
Yes, we in nephrology have always felt that UACRs are not necessarily being done, often because the patients coming to us are missing a UACR, and we're all about urine. We're into urine. So this is LabCorp data. This is LabCorp data from 2013 to 2018, prior to the pandemic. And what we found was that 80% of the high-risk patients, those patients with either hypertension, diabetes, or both, weren't tested during this entire time. This population, most of them, it was a UACR. Part of that is because the CMP automatically calculates the eGFR, but if you don't order the urine with it, we tried to, so within like Quest and LabCorp, there's something called a kidney profile. I admit we stole it from the cardiology group and the diabetes group because they had, you know, thyroid profile or cholesterol profile. So kidney profile automatically orders both a blood and a urine, and you don't even have to think about it. The other problem we've run into is some of the labs call it a microalbuminuria and a macroalbuminuria. And so you're not quite sure what you're ordering. So it's important. A microalbuminuria means the amount of albumin between 30 and 300, which is the at-risk group. You are already dumping albumin. And so ordering the microalbuminuria will be the same as ordering a UACR. And again, part of this whole thing has to do with different words used, different, and we're just frustrated that we can't seem to order a urine, order a kidney profile.
Yeah, I think you bring up a very good point. And we did data analysis in 2009 to 2011, looking at primary care with treating persons with diabetes. And we ran their data similarly. We questioned the healthcare providers ahead of time, how they felt at measuring or ordering a urinary albumin creatinine ratio. And you know, many of them said, oh, I have 95% of my patients. And we went back 18 months in their EHR data. And you know what percentage of persons with diabetes got a UACR in 18 months? Only 3%. And
oh my goodness.
It was quite enlightening for them. So, you know, one of the things I do in my electronic health record as a primary care to remind myself is in my notes, in my templated notes, I have a toggle that says UACR. And every time I engage and interact with this patient, I need to populate that field. And so it's a great reminder. I've also trained my medical assistant in our practice to reconcile that, to make sure that it has been ordered on a yearly basis. And she goes ahead and orders that for me. And so it's a way to try and create a workflow and overcome that barrier, because as you've shown us and demonstrated today, Kim, it is so imperative that we have both metrics ongoing and obtain them and to be real with ourselves. We think we're doing it, but we're probably not. And then creating a workflow where we can capture that data, remind ourselves and obtain it so we can identify and keep pace with these patients. Thanks so much for reviewing that testing and monitoring for kidney disease.
We're always thrilled to share. We're thrilled to answer questions, but please, please, urine. Think nephrology, think urine.
Just say yes to pee.
Yes, I love it.
You know, if we take it one step further and look at the standards of medical care and diabetes that came out in 2022, we're actually really encouraged to go beyond just optimizing glucose control. We know that if we improve glycemia, we improve the progression of kidney disease because we're affecting the small vessels. But many of my colleagues fail to go beyond just glucose because, as I've said before, you know, persons don't necessarily die from high sugars. They die from heart attack and stroke, which also has a comorbidity of kidney disease with it. And so for persons with type 2 diabetes, either with early kidney disease or advanced kidney disease, we have to be mindful of the therapies that we are choosing for them. And we will be going through this in our next module, but we know we need to screen. We know we have a person with diabetes. We know we're trying to impact their glycemia. We know now that we need to do at least an annual eGFR or a urinary microalbumin creatinine ratio, at least annual. We're looking for that normal range of what we call microalbumin, or are we determining that this individual is spilling protein at a higher rate, which before the GFR changes means they're at risk for advanced kidney disease. So if their advanced kidney disease risk is there, we now have to shift our treatment intervention to include agents that affect glycemia or affect kidney disease, and then ultimately affect cardiovascular disease, because it's this cascade that just tends to domino effect through it. And so that's why we spend so much time on screening, because you need to do a directional change beyond just glucose control. You need to look at the person from a three-dimensional picture, looking at the kidney, looking at the heart, looking at the glycemia. And we're going to explore some of those agents of how they do more than just glucose control, how they specifically intervene with that cardio renal metabolic access. Now we'll take a moment and discuss the recommendation and the evidence regarding management of both type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and cardiovascular comorbidities. You know, one of the things that comes up in the primary care world when we're looking at the ADA recommendations is we look at those individuals who have diabetes, and we all know that metformin is the first line medication that we use for intervention. But the next question comes up is, what do we do after that? And in the ADA guidelines in 2022, you really have two subheadings. You have those that have cardiovascular disease, and then you have those that have kidney disease. Now, one would argue, as we see persons with diabetes in and out, and in your practice, Kim, for sure, they all have those comorbidities. But, you know, two out of three of persons with diabetes are going to have cardiovascular disease in their lifetime. But they really want us to kind of identify a person with diabetes of what they bring to the table next. In other words, what are those secondary metrics that is going to help guide us into a direction for therapy? So Kim, what are some of the current recommendations for like metrics and maximizing our options for persons with diabetes who may either have an impaired renal function or cardiovascular disease?
Well, and part of that is, as I said, our patient population dies of cardiovascular disease. In the ADA guidelines, they talk about a 10-year risk with cardiac disease. By definition, if you have a diagnosis of CKD, you are high risk. You don't even have to calculate it. I can remember at a couple meetings, somebody in primary care going, oh, do you calculate? I'm like, no, my patients are just high risk, period. And so what we have is that patient population, and we want to protect their hearts. We want to protect their hearts as much as we can. We actually have lower goals for blood pressure. Our goal is 120 for the systolic. Originally in the SPRINT trial, there were a number of patients who developed what acute kidney injury, AKI, with this lower goal. But what we found was that even if those patients had continued treatment, and a lot of them were blinded, so they were continued treatment, at a year out, they did better. The AKI was more physiological. It just had to do with volume. It was not actual injury to the kidney. So we know that even a 70-year-old patient with diabetes, and of course, by definition, 70, you have a little heart disease, you have CKD, and those patients still do better at a lower blood pressure. We do not know the diastolic goal, and so therefore we never printed one. The blood pressure goals at ADA are still up at the 130 over 80, and we're telling you it's safe. Take them down. Take them down to 120. And we really want these patients treated aggressively because, again, they're going to die of cardiovascular disease. You know, we're trying to stop end-stage organ failure. And the ones I can control the kidney failure, I have machines. I can't control the cardiac. We have about a 25% death rate. Once you meet me in stage four, you will have a high death rate for cardiovascular disease. And so it's important that we be aggressive with blood pressure control. We be aggressive to identify and treat these patients.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. If I put it in kind of the lens of primary care, when I have a person in front of me that has diabetes, I often kind of ask myself, what else does this individual in front of me need? And I'll look at their family history. I'll look at whether they have high blood pressure or even, as you mentioned, those metrics, even if they're close to being that way, we don't have to wait till they cross the line, right? We know that they're kind of flirting with that as well. Do they have obesity or metabolic related issues? Do they have hyperlipidemia? Once they've had the event, once they're in your wheelhouse, I hope we can all identify those. But in the primary care setting, I'm trying to go beyond glycemia. I'm looking at the individual in front of me. What metrics are they showing? Are they showing a little bit of protein? Are they showing a little bit of hypertension? Do they have dysmetabolism and hyperlipidemia? Do they have a family history of cardiovascular disease? To your credit, you don't really have to do the calculator. All of us are very highly educated individuals. We know the trajectory that a person is going, but I think you're great in what you said. You cannot hurt them by doing this. You can only help them. And in fact, we always want to be preventative with our patients. And so if I tee that up with the patients, I'm trying to treat your current glycemia and your future cardiovascular and future renal risk. We're not wanting to wait till it occurs. We're trying to be identify it, do a path and on a trajectory to impact that. You know, if we go one step further, Kim, how do we unpack some of the specific features we're talking about? And then how do we make choices for the treatment in the management of chronic kidney disease?
In 2021, we published guidelines for which medications to choose for CKD. And while we all always hope for a lifestyle, what we know is that by the time our patients have developed CKD, they need to be treated more aggressively. Metformin is still our medication of choice to start with, but often by the time you get to us, we need to have been more aggressive. We want SGLT2s and metformin started concurrently and aggressively at the first sign of diabetes. Now, realistically, in the United States, that can't happen. You have to fail one before you can get the second one covered under the insurance. And so often what will happen is we'll have metformin and then the A1C is still too high and then they'll add SGLT2. And it's important that you realize that SGLT2s they work in the kidney and they are protective of the kidney. They're also protective of the heart, which goes back to our argument that our patients will die of heart disease. After these, then we have the choices of GLPs, DPP-4s. And the reason we picked SGLT2s has to do with hazard ratios. We know that SGLT2s are very, very, very good with our patients. It works at the level of the kidney. You pee off any sugar above 180. If your blood glucose is above 180, you're going to pee it off. The other advantage is you also pee off fluid and sodium. So it works kind of as a double whammy. It helps as blood pressure and it helps also with diabetes. But when you look at risk factors, the risk with the other medications are significantly higher. Now, you, Eden, use all the different meds. Have you noticed problems with other issues?
Absolutely. You bring up a really good point. Many of our colleagues will choose meds based on formulary coverage, based on familiarity. I often say they're not purposeful in choosing the meds. They're more reactionary to all the things that govern them. And so oftentimes we'll see sulfonylureas used, and they're not even in here as a hazard ratio, but you and I know that sulfonylureas are not nephroprotective. They are probably inexpensive, but they got a lot of baggage. They don't promote cardiovascular health. They have hypoglycemia, which is terrible in those persons with acute kidney injury. They don't have the ability to recover. And so I rarely will choose that medication because it doesn't benefit us as a holistic person. In addition, many are using DPP-4s due to their ease of use, their limited side effect profile. But as you can see here, DPP-4s are a very neutral medication. They're not very potent in glycemic reduction. In addition, they don't have any secondary weight effect. They don't protect and preserve the kidney, and they don't do anything for cardiovascular disease. In some cases, they actually can contribute to heart failure. So to bring up something that you mentioned a minute ago about concomitant starting of medication, I'm all for combination therapy, because if you were to leverage medications such as a GLP-1 and an SGLT2, you're covering all your bases physiologically, but you're also impacting kidney. As you can see here, even GLP-1s improve kidney overall health, probably because of the secondary effects on the heart and metabolically, but you're really creating a medication story or a medication plan. And to get these covered, this is what I say. I put in the note at the end. I'm not just treating glycemia, because the American College of Cardiology and the American Diabetes Association say you can add these agents after metformin if you're just trying to impact cardiovascular risk or kidney risk. You don't have to have an elevated A1C. So if you put that in the plan, this note is to authorize the use of this agent for this reason, endorsed by this governing body, to reduce this risk, even though the A1C is on target, because for many cardiovascular disease, the A1C is independent. It's how you treat this. And so this is how I impact beyond just glucose and kind of circumvent the payer, because they're really not following the guidelines that are out there. And in my note, I remind them what the guidelines are so I can go beyond just glycemia.
And you know, it's funny, because while I hear from primary care and non-nephrology that they get pushback, we don't get pushback. By the time they realize how expensive we are, I mean, dialysis itself is over $70,000 a year. And SGLT2, not even close. So, having the diagnosis code of CKD also helps things get covered. SGLT2s are progressively found to be better and better. Kidneys were kind of a side of, thing originally. We were not even in the studies. And now we are where people are going to. Credence, and I had a lot of patients in Credence. Credence had our patient population with diabetes. And what we found was that we were able to slow progression to kidney failure. We were able to lower albuminuria, which again, remember, predictive. We know that if you have albuminuria and you have a lot of it, you're going to meet me. And so these were the patients who were our population. And it was fascinating, because we were able to show the A1C didn't change that much, but we protected the kidneys and the heart. And again, the goal is to cover for any kind of end organ damage. And so it's important to think outside the box. An A1C, while we follow it, is not necessarily as predictive as the numbers when you look at their cardiac and their kidney endpoints. So then DAPA CKD actually came in, and it was able to even slow for patients who didn't have diabetes. And so there actually is an FDA approval for giving DAPA for CKD only. We can slow progression of CKD. We know that it reduces the albuminuria, and it works really well for weight and blood pressure. You know, they say it's 4 millimeters for systolic blood pressure, but I have to say we see closer to 8 to 10. We see enough that it's a blood pressure medication, essentially. You can lower the uric acid, which a lot of our patients have gout, because as one can imagine, the crystals just are in the kidney and they really just cause some problems. And again, kidney stones, lower the risk. all of these are positive outcomes from SGLT2s.
Well, you know, it kind of sounds like to me, Kim, that SGLT2s are cardiorenal metabolic drugs that happen to lower glucose, right?
Yes. You're incidental to us. We want them.
I'm just a backseat now, right?
Yeah. You know,
but it does bring that up. And sometimes I kind of have to pause and chuckle when I communicate this to my persons with diabetes. I talk about the multiple benefits. They sometimes in kind of a joking way say, do SGLT2s not do something?
And yes, exactly. We don't think so. We think they are the end all be all right now. You know, we'll see as we go along. But yes, we think that definitely all of our patients. And going back to your comment about sulfonylureas, my patient population tends to be older, a little unstable, and, you know, they have multiple comorbidities. The sulfonylureas are causing a lot of falls. We're seeing a lot of the hypoglycemia, and it's just scary when you have a 75-year-old diabetic CKD patient on a sulfonylurea, and it really should not be done.
It's too risky. You know, if we go one step further, Kim, and talk about other agents that are out there, such as finerenone, can you give us a little bit of introduction to that so our listeners can be kind of comfortable with it as an agent? And then talk a little bit about, you know, some of the side effects or things to watch out for, such as hyperkalemia.
There is a new class of drugs, MRAs. There are non-steroidal MRAs and steroidal MRAs. Steroidal MRAs have been out there forever. Spironolactone is the most common. It was used a lot in cardiology. We in nephrology don't use it much at all. Not only does it cause the gynecomastia that our patients complain about, but it causes severe hyperkalemia. And so within our patient population, it was not well used. However, the non-steroidal MRA is the finerenone. And finerenone has been introduced about 6 months ago. And I tell you, it's been working extremely well for that patient population where you still have albuminuria. And not only does the ADA recommend it as a second level drug, so do the new KDIGO diabetes guidelines. What we know is this medication is cardioprotective and renal protective. It seems to decrease the inflammation, and that is how it seems to work. Now, there is a question, because it is non-steroidal versus steroidal MRAs, whether or not you still have a little bit of hyperkalemia. What I'm hearing from colleagues who have been using it, and for some reason, Alabama uses more of finerenone than anyone else. And what I'm hearing from my colleagues is that when they put the MRA along with the SGLT2, they actually do not run into the hyperkalemia that may be a side effect. And they're also finding that the finerenone increases EPO production in the kidney. And so they're not seeing the anemia. And that seems to be also cardioprotective. Not only does it directly protect the heart, but it seems to also, some of its quote side effects are very, very cardio and renal protective.
Wow, that's such a nice tool that we can add on. You know, my thought always is, you know, okay, I have a person with diabetes. I want to choose an agent that does more than one thing. But here you're telling me about an agent that is purely related to kidney in terms of diabetes, but not affecting glycemia, but rather we add it on. And those individuals, you know, they're GFR 30 and above, they still have issues of proteinuria or advancing kidney disease, that you add this concomitant agent to it, that you're always mindful of the potassium level, because especially in the lower ranges, these people can have that, but it might be a better additional agent than some of the other agents, such as spironolactone, that do have that higher hyperkalemia. So being introduced to this agent, getting familiar with how it works and how you add it on, as well as identifying that person, you know, we're really going to be covering the kidney in many different factors, predominantly so they never see you, Kim, right?
Well, the kidneys and the heart, again, you know, the inflammation is general. That's the metabolic disease is not in one particular area. And so that's why this works really well. So a patient with CKD starts with a RAS, I don't care whether it's an ACE or an ARB, they're interchangeable. Move on to, if you are diabetic, metformin. If not, SGLT2, because again, you don't have to be diabetic for that. And then you can move on to, for our diabetics who are still dumping albumin, then we move on to finerenone. And it's just a stepwise process. And we find that it is extremely effective. We will increase lifespans of these patients. And that's vitally important.
Yeah, you know, it's developing that plan, that interventional plan, those pieces of their puzzle, and having a good working knowledge of each of these agents and how they interact. You know, I kind of want to wrap us up with talking about what are the best practices and how we communicate to our patients who have diabetes, who we want to identify. We want to ongoing monitor, and we want to include those therapeutic interventions. You know, I know it starts with me. I think I've learned a lot today about being mindful of beyond the glycemia, always keeping an eye on the kidney, which then in keeping an eye on the complications of cardiovascular, communicating that to our patients, being aware of the recommendations of the ADA and KDIGO, as well as the American College of Cardiology. And so, you know, how do you do that best practices in your intervention with persons with diabetes and kidney disease?
So again, by the time you meet me, we have progressed quite far. So I do a lot of outreach to primary care, to endocrine, to PAs and NPs and docs who see my patients earlier. We know that the patient population is much more likely to progress are those patients of color. And yet, when trials go out there, patients of color are less likely to be given SGLT2s, yet I'm showing you data and guidelines, and yet we're not seeing it. And this is the patients I'm going to have. And I love my patients, but you don't want to come to me. I mean, we want to get aggressive with these patients early. If you're a white male, you're treated with an SGLT2 at 2 times the rate of everybody else. And so even as a white female, I worry because I'm like, oh goodness, they're not going to treat me with the known medications that are out there to protect my heart and my kidneys. And so it's important that we get out to the population who will progress in kidney disease, and we get out, we aggressively treat them, and we aggressively treat them early. So that's why I love doing any kind of talk, any kind of outreach to my community, my colleagues, because I know that you don't want to come to my office, and I can slow down progression, take your blood pressure down to 120, start the patients on SGLT2s. It will take their blood pressure down, and it will protect their kidney and their heart. Make sure they're on a RAS. Make sure that you test to see albumin, because again, that will tell you who you have to be more and more aggressive with. It's important that you make sure that if you still are dumping albumin, you go to the next step. You go to the finerenones. These medications are now out there. They're known to work, but we need to get the information out because it has to be done early, long before you meet nephrology.
Yeah, we have to be more than one-dimensional in diabetes. We need to be three-dimensional. So many of you are monitoring diabetes. So the thing to take away is check the kidneys, check them frequently, yes. Check the serum, check the urine, identify that individual of what stage they're in, pull up that KDIGO heat map, which is what I do on my computer screen in the office, because sometimes the first time a patient has a conversation regarding kidney disease is when they get that lab that says GFR less than 60 and it says chronic kidney disease. And they're like, you never said anything. So be the first person to identify. And even if you're telling them right now you're at stage 2, you know, the GFR is in range, that you don't have any protein, you're still keeping pace with that. And then second of all, it is in primary care where we're going to use these agents. These are in the wheelhouse of primary care. The SGLT2s, the RASs, the MRAs, these are not specialty meds. In fact, You're telling me that these are early interventional meds that we can do to prevent them from seeing you. Even though we're so glad for the work you do, respectfully, I want to do my job up front so they don't metastasize to other organs and end up having to do damage control. Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining me today, giving the other perspective at the other side of the disease. And it's just been a pleasure working with you and discovering and going in depth into how we impact kidney disease and diabetes.
And truly, I am trying to put myself out of business and I need your help to do so, please. Eden is right. This is all in your wheelhouse, please. Learn about the meds and go ahead and try them. They really are incredibly effective and they will slow progression of both kidney disease and cardiovascular disease. Thank you. Thank you, Eden, for your time.
Thank you so much for pairing with me today.